I've had an interesting week. I've seen a real miracle watching Bill Carlson come back from death's doorstep, turn around and start heading back towards the land of the living. That was an extraordinary thing. And I also had a conversation with someone, and I haven't been told this since 1967. They said, and I quote, "Looking mighty shaggy." My response was, yes. The title of this message is an introduction to the resurrection of the dead. You're going to have to pay attention. This is not one of the normal messages where you can fall asleep and just wander off in thoughts. If you're going to follow me, you're going to have to pay attention. If you need these notes, they are available from me later on. Techiat Hametim, or Machaya Hametim, the resurrection of the dead, has been debated amongst the Jewish people for somewhere between 2,500 and 3,000 years now. In the body of Messiah, it's been debated for some 2,000 years. The day of the event, who gets resurrected, how many resurrections there are, and the sequencing of those resuscitations are all subject to machlechet hashamayim, arguments for the sake of heaven, where people sit down and discuss and argue things to get deeper in understanding of the things of the spiritual realm. During the counting of the Omer, I would like to look at the various concepts that surround resurrection. And unlike many others, I will refrain from taking a dogmatic approach to this subject because I find it produces far more heat than light. There are things in the scriptures that are stated expressly, and therefore they require an affirmation by believers. There are other ideas that are a bit more ambiguous. Some of them are deduced. Some of them are interpreted. And these allow for discussion. And they can tolerate disagreement. Reasonable people can disagree on certain subjects. On Omer Reshit, the Feast of First Fruits, Yeshua rose from the dead. First fruits in the first century always fell on Sunday. Therefore, Shavuot also always fell on Sunday in the Sadducean calendar. But not everybody in the first century believed there was actually a resurrection that would take place. Most notably, the Sadducees denied the concept utterly, and they were rather obnoxious in that disagreement, as we see in Mark chapter 12 and in Matthew chapter 22, where Yeshua is approached by them and some ridiculous scenario is proposed about a woman getting married and remarried and remarried, and finally she dies. Whose wife is she? And Yeshua dismisses it. You do err not knowing the scriptures. There is no giving and taking in marriage in heaven. We shall appear like the angels, creatures of light. Today would be fine. To understand the difference between the Pharisees and the Sadducees, many in the body of Messiah have don't really have a handle on that difference, and I would like to give a loose analogy to the body of Messiah that will suffice to describe these differences and give you a concept of the Pharisee and the Sadducee. The Sadducees were tantamount to the Catholic Church, okay? They were the priests of the temple. They determined the festival dates. As I said before, the Pharisees disagreed on the date of first fruits and Shavuot. But it was celebrated when the Sadducees said it would be celebrated. They were the priests. They were the official expression of the Jewish faith to everyone. The Sadducees were the ones in power. They anointed the kings in Israel. They were the final authority on all matters religious. They were the judges that would judge between cases. They sat in the seat of Moses. They represented Judaism to all other nations outside Israel, including, and most obviously, Rome. The Pharisaic movement, in this analogy, was the Protestant movement in first century Judaism. Pharisees believed that the priesthood had become a corrupt political entity that was influenced by Greek and Roman culture more than the Judean philosophy and theologies that were birthed in Israel. The defilement of the Sadducean priesthood began some 200 to 300 years before the first century began, in what we call the intertestament period. It happened within a short period of time after the Maccabean revolt with John Hyrcanus. He exalted himself and he became the king and the high priest of Israel, and the Sadducees at that point became a completely political entity. Now, the Pharisees began as a unified resistance to the secularization of the Sadducee priesthood. And as the Protestant movement in the church, they quickly splintered into many different factions, or what we would call denominations. Various rabbis would rise to prominence, and their students would gather around them to learn at schools that were dispersed all around Israel. They were called Beit HaMidrash, the house of teaching or the house of preaching. They were basically the synagogues. Yeshua visited a number of these throughout his ministry in Nazareth, Capernaum, or Capernaum, and he would teach there. They had no official capacity in Judaism. Pharisees and Messianics were the only factions of the Jewish people to survive the first century. All others were either destroyed, like the Essene community by the 10th Roman Legion on the shores of the Dead Sea, or the Sadducees disappeared because there's now no temple. They have no job. Those who were in power now have nothing to rule over when the temple was destroyed. The Pharisees survived because they were decentralized. They had all these synagogues all over the place, and that was their realm, that was their area of purview. The Messianics survived because we're the temple of the living God. According to our teacher, we are the temple. And so we survived that first century as an identifiable group. Many of the priests, we're told, became believers in Yeshua after the temple was destroyed. Hillel and Shammai represented the two largest schools in first century Israel. And they disagreed about just about everything. I mean, they couldn't agree on whether or not it was daytime out. One of my favorite examples is the Hanukkah. Should it be lit from the left to the right? Should it be lit from the right to the left? Do you start with one candle and go to eight, or do you start with eight and diminish the light with each passing day? And after giving this some 40 years of thought, the halacha on this particular point is according to Bert, who has brought peace to the situation. If you believe that you should light from the left to the right, you should do that. And if you're with somebody else who believes the candle should be lit from the right to the left, he should go to the other side of the table. Seek to be at peace with all men and holiness, without which no one will see God. If you have any further problems, please see me later, and I will help you resolve these things. Sometimes God gives me clarity into a situation. I say that to the silliness to me is profound. I would not spend more than any time arguing over such matters. To make an analogy within Judaism today, the Pharisees of the first century are analogous to the modern Hasidic movement. The modern Hasidic movement, well, even when it first began in the 1700s with the Baal Shem Tov, has always been shrouded in mystery. A lot of secrecy that surrounds it. Their rituals were held very often in outdoors, in the woods and such. The Baal Shem Tov was a remarkably charismatic individual, and he had some very strange ideas concerning God and man for what was then Jewish. He was outside the pale. The Hasidic movement is a very narrow flow within Judaism. Their strict observance to Torah is similar to all the Orthodox. However, the Hasidim place a far greater emphasis on the mystical writings of the Kabbalah, primarily Devakut, the adhesion or the cleaving to God, as it is portrayed in a marriage. There is the Aliyat Hanashoma, the rising of the, from the word Aliyah. You make an Aliyah here, you come up. The coming up of the soul to be joined with God, to adhere to Him, to draw close. That teaching drew many people because they were tired of just simply reciting prayers every single day, three times a day, over and over, the same words. They wanted what they saw in Scripture. Frankly, they were similar to me when I left the shul. I wanted more than just reciting the same words every day. I read about Moses drawing nigh to God, coming close, hearing his voice. I wanted that. I wanted a personal relation. I wanted my soul to rise up. It drew many. However, the Pharisee, like the Hasidim, were not monolithic. There are literally hundreds of different factions that make up the Hasidic movement in Judaism. Deep divisions are revealed as each Hasidic sect follows the teachings of a different rabbi. Today, the two largest flows within the Hasidic movement are the Satmir and the Lubavitch. The Satmir Rebbe and the Lubavitch Rebbe. The most famous of those were Schneerson, of course, for the Lubavitch. Their divisions were very similar to Hillel and Shammai in the first century, and these two sects of Hasidim are deeply divided over almost everything. In the 1950s in Brooklyn, there was physical fights between these two sects. Perhaps the most essential and significant disagreement was over the modern state of Israel, which when I was born was only 2 years old. The Satmir do not believe that the modern state of Israel should exist without the Mashiach, while the Lubavitch support the modern state of Israel as it stands right now. These divisions were truly significant. They would cut each other's beards. It was silly on one hand, but it showed the profundity of this disagreement, the depth. However, with all the divisions amongst Jews in the first century that's carried over till today, there exists certain fundamental beliefs that bind all of the Hasidic factions as well as all Jews who believe in God together. And many of those would include the Messianic Jews as well. And these are encompassed in Maimonides' 13 principles of faith. To the Pharisees and their children, modern-day rabbis, the resurrection is an absolutely essential belief to be considered a Jew. According to the Pharisees, Maimonides, and the present-day rabbis, if you don't believe in the resurrection, you are outside the pale of Judaism. You are gone. You're not considered Jewish. Now, the division between the Sadducees and the Pharisees is historically documented. I mentioned Mark and Matthew that refer to that division over the resurrection. In Acts chapter 23, Paul has been called before council, and he perceives that this council consists of Sadducees and Pharisees. And he, in a very clever fashion actually, diverts their attention off of him using the resurrection. And he declares, "Brethren, I am a Pharisee, and I am on trial for the hope and resurrection of the dead." And almost immediately, the council descends into this chaotic kind of pill pool, arguing back and forth over the resurrection, and Paul is forgotten. It's very clever on Paul's part. Now, first, the resurrection that I am addressing here, that Paul spoke of, that Yeshua spoke of, is not the resurrection that, it is not a resuscitation or a reanimation of a dead body, ba'olem hazeh, in this world. That has already been accomplished on numerous occasions, and it's recorded in the scriptures. Three times the resurrection of the dead is recorded in connection with Elijah and Elisha. In 1 Kings 17, Elijah prays and raises up a lad, a young boy. In 2 Kings chapter 4, Elisha raises up the son of a Shunammite woman. And in 2 Kings chapter 13, the lifeless body of a man is put in Elisha's tomb. And as soon as that lifeless body touches one of the bones of Elisha, that body rises up and walks forth from the tomb. Yeshua himself resurrects people. He resurrected Lazarus. In Luke chapter 7, he resurrects the only child of a widow. In Luke chapter 8, he resurrects the daughter of Jairus. And Paul himself performs a resurrection. He was waxing eloquent. And his sermon went on and on, like some of you might think. And there's a young man who is listening at the window. And finally, he goes to sleep, falls out of the window, and he dies. And Paul comes by, resurrects him. I assume because Paul did not wish to have the reputation that when he preaches, people die. This is not a good reputation for a preacher, so he gets he raises up the young child. I have a similar gifting. I am currently making a few extra bucks on the side, going to various sleep centers where people who haven't been able to schluffen for years, I begin to preach, and within 10 minutes, they're out. And some of them can sleep for literally days. As I've always said from this pulpit, if you have a gift, use it for the betterment of mankind, and it will be counted unto you as righteousness. Now, although all the raising of the dead in the Tanakh and the New Covenant are indeed resurrections, they are fundamentally different than the future resurrection our sages and Yeshua speak of. All these died and were resuscitated. They lived the rest of their lives, and then they died again. The New Covenant declares that Yeshua is the first fruits of those who sleep. He was the first to be resurrected in a form that would not die again. In fact, could not die again. 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verse 20 affirms the Pharisaic belief that Mashiach would rise first, and then those who believed in him or were at one with him would then follow in that resurrection. And just as a side note, if the first Messiah is to be resurrected, he must have died. So this concept of the first Mashiach dying is not alien to the Jewish mind. It was found for thousands of years within Judaism. Psalm 16. He shall not allow his Holy One to undergo decay. The Mashiach would not decay like all other bodies. He would go down but be very much alive. Minister, speak to the people in Sheol, just like the New Covenant says. And then they would rise up, just as it's proposed in the Brit Hadashah, in the New Covenant. Now, the precise nature of the body that will be resurrected is beyond the scope of this introduction. In fact, it's probably beyond the scope of our understanding, period. We have nothing to relate it to. I will look more closely at this in subsequent messages. Isaiah chapter 26, verse 19 speaks of the resurrection that I am referring to in this message. It says, your dead shall live, my corpses shall arise. Awaken and sing, you who dwell in the dust. For tal arot, the dew of lights is your dew, and the earth will cast out her dead. This is one of the most beautiful and mystical understandings amongst my people. Tal arot, the dew of lights. It is called in other places Tal HaShamayim, the heavenly dew. And as the dew of nature, out on the plains, you can see it. You can't trace where it came from. It all of a sudden appears on the earth, and everything sparkles as the sun comes up. And it brings with it life. It waters the grasses that appear dead, the trees that appear dead, and all of a sudden you start to see green and you realize they're not dead. They but slept for the winter, and now this dew is bringing them back to life. It is truly a resurrection. That's why many times you read in the New Covenant and throughout Talmud, those who sleep, or those who sleep with the fathers. Death doesn't have that kind of permanence in the theology of my people. And the mechanics of the resurrection that I'm speaking about here is that this tal orot, this dew of light, would appear, come down from heaven and appear on the earth. And it would start to saturate the earth and permeate the earth with light. And just like when that body touched the bones of Elisha, it rose up. When the bodies that lay in the grave are touched by the light of the heavenly dew, they also rise up and they walk around within sight of those who are alive. We'll discuss this more when we discuss the first resurrection of the dead, which happened 2,000 years ago at the death of Yeshua. When the dead rose up and walked around in Jerusalem, and many saw. That was quite a day. I'm just saying, yeah, that was quite a day. Daniel chapter 12, verse 2 speaks of this. Many of them that slept in the land of dust shall awake. 1 Samuel chapter 2, verse 6, the Lord kills and makes alive. He brings down to Sheol and he raises up. There are many others, but these should suffice. So the question that is within the title of this message is, why is the resurrection of the dead an essential part of a faith in God within Judaism, regardless of whether it's Pharisaic or Messianic? Why? The Talmud is very strong on this matter. Talmud declares that he who does not believe in the resurrection is Epikoros. He's anathema. He's accursed, damned. The Gemara, the commentary on this point, states that without a faith in resurrection, one is forever separated from God. Those who believe that speak in terms of the utter annihilation of the soul. It's utterly disintegrated. It no longer exists. Others speak in terms of an eternal punishment, while others still speak of a combination of both, where one condition is a consequence of the other condition. We'll deal with this more in one of the messages I give in this series on the nature of hell. But Yeshua affirms the Pharisaic belief on the centrality of Tichiat HaMetim. The resurrection of the dead is the primary focus of Yeshua during his ministry here on earth. It is the primary focus. The resurrection provides the theological underpinnings for his teachings on righteousness, holiness, and the world to come. All of Yeshua's teachings on morality, ethics, eschatology are all tied inextricably to the resurrection. Why? What makes the resurrection such an essential point, the bullseye in the center of the bullseye? My answer will appear first as hyperbole, an exaggerated statement that is untrue, but in a moment, you'll agree with me. It will prove to be obvious and a required reality. If there is no resurrection, there is no point, nor is there any power to God's word. I know, that's over the top. You will agree with me in just a moment. There are three points to consider from the Brit Hadashah on that statement that I just made. Paul declares in 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verse 19. If then in this life only we have hope in Messiah, we are of all men most miserable. If Mashiach is our only hope here, or if Messiah in this world is the only hope we have, we're miserable. Why? Because those who follow Messiah, the world is enmity with God, those who follow Messiah are oftentimes persecuted for following Messiah. If our hope is in Messiah here only, then the very fact that we have hope in him brings persecution, not joy. So we are miserable. Secondly, we have refrained from earthly pleasures in this life. We have lived our lives as a preparation for a world to come, and it has all been delusion. If there is no resurrection, there is no world to come. Or if there is, it's empty. There's nobody in it. 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verse 32, which is Scripture's most exhaustive treatment of the subject of resurrection, it says, if the dead are not raised, let us eat, let us drink, tomorrow we die. If the dead do not rise, there are no consequences for our actions in this world. And therefore, Paul concludes that we should take whatever pleasure from this life that we can. We should live to satisfy the desires of the flesh, the lusts of the eyes, the pride of life. Do whatever you want. Because once this flesh is gone, there is nothing else if there is no resurrection. The underlying premise of all of this in Paul's argument is that without a resurrection, there is no justice. There is no punishment for living a wicked life. And if no punishment, there is no deterrent. There's no fear of the Lord. Similarly, if there's no reward for living a righteous life, there's nothing to draw me to God. If both the wicked and the righteous end up in the same place, oblivion, what's the difference? Why live righteous? Eat, drink, be merry, enjoy yourself. There's no resurrection, there's no power. Those are the two points in the first. Number two, to deny the resurrection is a practical denial of the neshama, the light and the breath of God that was breathed into man when he became a living soul. If there is only a nefesh, an animal soul, when the body dies, it returns to the dust. The nefesh, the natural breath, returns to the atmosphere. And everything that person was dies with him, as if he never lived. What happens to the breath of God that was breathed in, the neshama? They don't talk about it much, but what happens to it? Does it just disintegrate? Does it disappear? How would something that is immortal in nature, God's breath, how would that disintegrate? The image of God is identifiable before this body is formed. Jeremiah, I knew you before you were in the womb. I designated a portion of my breath to be you. And even before that breath was in that body that it would inhabit, I knew you. I knew that breath. Jeremiah was identified prior to being born. Without a resurrection, there would be no continued identification of that body after death. But there is. On the Mount of Transfiguration, who appears with Yeshua? And how do we know it's them? Somehow, those two souls were recognizable. They weren't, obviously, in the bodies that they inhabited here. There was something peculiar about those bodies. but they somehow were identifiable as Moses and Elijah. We see this, every person in here who's ever seen someone they loved die has seen this. When my first wife, I watched the light come out of her, and I knew she was dead. That body that had attracted me, or the form that had attracted me for 28 and a half years, now was almost repulsive. I didn't embrace her because I knew she was not in there any longer. She had left. Sylvia was gone. All that was left was that body. See, this is not birth. This is just a container that holds birth. And at some point, birth will vacate this container as well. This is a temporary situation. It's a container. Thirdly, a denial of the resurrection would render God a liar. God promised the fathers and their children that they will all live in the land that God described to Abraham. None ever have, not a single one. If there is no resurrection, that promise could not possibly be fulfilled, and God would be a liar. God must resurrect those souls in order to be able to fulfill his promises to Abraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. It's the entire point behind the reasoning of Hebrews 11. With the Akedah Yitzchak, the binding of Isaac, God promised Abraham that his seed would continue through Yitzchak. And then God tells him, sacrifice Yitzchak. So what was the faith of God, of Abraham? That God would resurrect, after the sacrifice, that God would resurrect Yitzchak to fulfill his promise that his seed would live. That's why Hebrews 11 speaks the way it does. And by the way, there are many in rabbinic Judaism that also conclude that Yitzchak actually died. And then his soul, the neshama, came back into him and he rose up. That it's in connection with this resurrection. That concept is within rabbinic Judaism as well. There is one last point that requires a resurrection, and it's more mystical, which means it's my favorite. Adam and Chava were created as immortal beings. Their immortality was the result of being created in the image of God, and B, having access to the tree of life that sustained that image. Their immortality was contingent on their remaining undefiled, not eating of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. On the day that they ate, their access to the tree of life was restricted, and they began to decay or die. It is believed that Adam and Chava were created and clothed with a garment of light. This is a deduced concept, and it is deduced using a reasoning principle called a fortiori. It is a reasoning from something that is lesser to something that is greater. You view something lesser, and then you deduce that it's something is greater in this new case. And the reasoning sounds like this. If Moses shined after his exposure to God in a limited fashion while he was hidden in the cleft of the rock, if Moses shined with that limited exposure, how much more Adam, who was not hidden and exposed to the full presence of God? If Moses shined with this limited, how much more Adam, where there was no limitation? a fortiori, a reasoning from a lesser to greater. It is my belief that Paul agrees with the idea that Adam and Chava were clothed in light, which is why he refers to us as creatures of light. In John chapter 1, verse 4, Yeshua was life, and the life was the light of man. If Yeshua lives within us, that life is light within us. It re-illuminates that neshama. It's why I refer to the neshama as a luminescent vapor, a breath that is filled with light as well. And I am told to allow that light to shine by Yeshua. Adam was literally a child of light. So am I. The glory of God's garment of light was diminished after Adam ate. Their earthen bodies were then revealed, and they were naked, and the scriptures say they were covered with a skin. It doesn't say animal skin. Many suppose it's animal skin. There are others who understand that light was the first garment, that they were literally creatures of light. And when that light was diminished, their bodies were revealed, and then God put a skin, the skin that we have now, over that body. The portion is ambiguous, and that's why there are so many different interpretations and understandings about it, and they are all irrelevant to what I'm speaking about. Doesn't matter. The germane point is this. As the grave, in the grave, that skin and the body disintegrate, and they are absorbed by the earth. The grave is preparing that body for a rebirth, a body that will be tikkun, restored to the glory it possessed before the first sin. As the womb prepares the child for life outside that container within the woman, the grave prepares the body for life outside Olam Hazeh, this world. And it's for this reason that throughout Talmud, the word kever, or grave, is translated womb. Rachma, womb. And just as contact with Elijah's bones results in the resurrection of man, of the man who was thrown in his tomb, contact with the Tal Orot, that dew of light that will saturate and permeate that tomb, as soon as the body that is dead comes in contact with that life, it too rises up, stands, and walks out. This is the way my people understand this resurrection. It is how we understood Genesis chapter 25, verse 6. Abraham breathed his last. His nefesh came out, the last breath. And he died. And then he was gathered, asif, harvested. He was gathered unto his people, his ancestors. Abraham dies, and he's reborn into the presence of his ancestors. It is precisely why Yeshua, when arguing over the resurrection with the Sadducees, who only, as I've stated many times before, they only believed in the Torah, the five books of Moses. They didn't believe in the prophets and the writings. So he couldn't use the prophets and the writings to prove the resurrection. He has to use the Torah. So he uses Abraham. Why? Because of Genesis chapter 25, verse 6. Abraham breathes his last, he dies, and then he's gathered unto his ancestors. Yeshua draws on that understanding that Abraham was alive. He was still alive after he breathed his last and died. Matthew 22, verse 31 and 32, but regarding the resurrection of the dead, have you not read what is spoken to you by God? I am the God of Abraham, the God of Yitzchak, the God of Yaakov. He is not the God of the dead. He's the God of the living. He is the God of the ones who have been a thief, the harvest. This is what happens at Chag Asif, what we call Sukkot, tabernacles. Souls are gathered. They rise up, and they live in the presence of Mashiach for 1,000 years. We'll get into that in more depth later as well. In Exodus chapter 27, verse 20, describes the procedure for extracting oil from the olives that would be burned in the menorah. And it says these olives would be katit lama'or. They would be crushed for light. They were put in a press. The olives were crushed down to nothing. The skin, the form of the olive was disintegrated. And the oil was squeezed out of these olives and then strained many times to make it pure and put in the menorah that would burn. In similar fashion, it is understood this flesh body, when it's in the grave, is crushed for light. As the body molders in the grave, it is crushed, and the light that it contains is extracted. Katit la ma'or, crushed in that grave, and the light extracted, and a man rises up in his original glory, a child of light. This is how my people understand this. Now, please, I'm trying to explain to you something. You don't have to agree with me. That really is irrelevant. I want you to understand how my people have understood the resurrection and why the resurrection is so essential to a faith in God. Death and resurrection are the final steps in Aliyat HaNeshama, the ascension of the soul. Throughout my life, I try to behave in a certain way, to do certain things that will raise up my soul. But the final point of ascension, when I quit this earth, is when that soul rises up. After it's been crushed for light, that light rises up, and I go to be with my Lord. I am gathered, asif, just like Abraham, to my ancestors and the Lord himself. And then shall be fulfilled the words, death, where is your sting? Grave, where is your victory? You couldn't hold me. Because of Yeshua, grave can't hold me. And I will close it out with this. My faith in resurrection is primarily what compels me to behave in a certain way. Some actions are compelled by a love for God, a desire to please him, that I might spend eternity with him, that I might receive a reward, and that reward is to hear the words, "Well done, true and faithful servant." I want to hear those words. I want to live in the mansion that he has prepared for me. But by far and away, it is the fear of the Lord that constrains my behavior. I am constrained by a holy wind that fears separation from God for eternity. If there was no resurrection, if you had something I want, what would compel me not to just kill you and take it? Why not? If there's no resurrection, why not? But because there is a resurrection, the why is simply, I know how my God would feel towards me if I behaved in such a way. And I know because he writes it in his book, and he tells me with precision how he would feel about me behaving in such a way. So the fear of the Lord constrains my behavior in some areas, while the love of God looses it in others to do things that I know will please him. This series, my prayer for this series of messages, which I don't have yet, all I've gotten is this one. So this might have been the entire series. Normally when God gives me a series of messages, I know what I'm preaching on for the next 4 to 6 weeks. This one, I got this. And next week, I will let you know what I got next week. I have no idea where I'm going next week. But it's my prayer that as the concept of resurrection becomes more clear and more real, that the reality of Olam Haba is something that you know exists, it will compel each of us to remain on Derech Hashem, the path of God. Let me bring this down, heaven down to earth, because remaining on that path is going to be challenged, is being challenged daily. Of a certainty, the world is going to make walking the path of God more arduous. It is going to try to convince us that none of this is real. They've already started that campaign. Be assured, hopefully in this series of messages, the resurrection is real, which means Olam Haba, the world to come, is real. You will be gathered as a harvest. You will stand before God, and you will give an account for your life, because your life does not end with this fleshly shell into which the glory of God was poured. Yeshua is real. He went to prepare a place for us, that where he is, we should be also. If it was not true, he would have told us. He said, I would have told you if this was not true. May we consider the reality of the resurrection and Olam Haba in everything that we do in this world. Father, in Yeshua's name, I thank you, Lord God, for the promise, the hope, and the power that you have given us through your Son resurrecting. The confidence and the comfort that comes with knowing this is not all there is. That there is a world that awaits, where there's no more pain or sadness, no more tears. No more mourning, no more death. A light, a luster that will surround us as we behold the glory of those who sit on the throne. And we will once again be able to partake of the tree of life. As this world is consumed in chaos and immersed in darkness, that place you have spoken to us about becomes more enticing, more of a comfort, a healing balm for our souls. Strengthen us in these days, Lord, that the light of your presence in us would shine forth brightly up against the darkness of this blackness of this world. In Yeshua's precious name, amen.